Well, are we ready, D?
Yep.
All right, hit it. Well, you already did. if you get a chance, you might go out and kind of listen to the podcast, because with D's recording now, it's much clearer, and people are getting a chance to hear your comments, which they're really enjoying. One of the things that I would point out here is that there are any changes in the church this week. Remember, when President Nelson's first years, we'd always say, okay, anything new this week? Yeah. There was a couple of changes this week.
55 new missions.
Including
North Texas, Dallas,
Dallas, Texas mission. What states that's going to include, we don't know yet, and where that's going to be, but we've had an east and we've had a west, and a friend of ours is the south mission president, and so now there's going to be a north, and what that'll take in, we don't know. They have made a couple of few changes to the Doctrine and Covenants headings. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Where traditionally, I think Elder McConkie had put in there that tithing replaced the law of consecration. When they couldn't, this is section 119. When they couldn't do the law of consecration, they shifted to the law of tithing. That wasn't it at all. And so they have changed that completely to say that that's not the case. Okay.
And those were made from the Joseph Smith papers, they said.
Yeah, and I think the church is now trying to rewrite things on their copy. One of the nice things about having the scriptures all online is that they can make those changes actually pretty rapidly. You don't have to do a complete reprinting. Okay, well, that's it. I'm glad you're here. This is a fun one. This is going to be a good time. And let me just say that as we're going to approach this a little bit differently. A few years ago, when the church said, we need to redo the history of the church, instead of doing from a standard historical context, strictly written by historians, just facts and figures and names and dates, the church had the historians supervising novelists and English professors and screenwriters and people that would write the history of the church through the eyes of people. So now if you're reading saints, you get stories, lots and lots of stories, and you're going to see the history going on through the eyes of the people that are participating in that. So from that standpoint, that's what they're doing, and that's what saints is. Well, we're going to do some of that. And so today I thought I would start. I knew quite a bit about B.H. Roberts. Mm-hmm. But the more I studied, the more I found, the more I just kept on going, and I've discovered a bunch of things that I didn't know about BH. But I also think that if we're studying Elder Roberts, we're also going to get a chance to see the history that he's living, which tells us what's going on in the church while he's doing that. Does that make sense? So lots of stories today.
Can I say something?
Sure.
And you have had so much fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every night I'm coming home going, did you know? Because I didn't know. These are pretty good. Okay? So B.H. Roberts is going to be kind of a mix between Oliver Twist and Forrest Gump. In that he's just everywhere doing everything. And then meeting Hugh Nibley, you know, just kind of this mix of all these three people. Okay, so let's jump into this a little bit. He's gonna make a statement himself that it's always kind of intrigued me in life. And here's what he's gonna say. In spite of different parentage and vicious environment, some characters arise that are truly virtuous and great, that purely by the strength of that intelligence and nobility to which their spirits attained in the heavenly kingdom before they took bodies on this earth. The grandeur of their soul could not be suppressed by environment in this life, however inauspicious their development. As the sun struggles through clouds and mists that are at times obscure the brightness, so these spirits, stirred by their innate nobility, breaking through all the disadvantages attendant upon ignoble birth and iron fortune, rise to their native heights of true greatness. Yeah. Somebody put that in different words. What is it that he's saying?
To read it again.
I mean, it's heavy, and I've read through this several times.
Sometimes you get Mother Teresa.
Who may be born next to somebody who does relatively...
Yeah, it just says that there are some people regardless are going to shine.
Yeah,
I think her comment is accurate. But some people are great in the pre-existence, and you may know some of those people. You just understand that they're extraordinarily intelligent and born with wisdom, born with attributes and with not necessarily direct knowledge, because they can't access that, but their souls, their self is great.
It just rise, and it seems to rise almost out of ashes sometimes, almost out of nothing. Yeah.
Little Orphan Annie.
Yeah. It's kind of like that.
And we like characters like that, right?
Kind of the rags to riches. Remember, so much of the 19th century, early, late 19th century, Horatio Alger, you know, the rags to riches, which is what it just, where did these people come from and how did they do it? Yeah.
Well, Jim Rohn, the great inspirational speaker, says good people are born, not trained.
I like that. And we wanted to ascribe it to training. But you have two kids born on the same block, and one's going to go on to greatness, and one's going to be a criminal, and you just wonder where they come from.
Thank you for giving me a second chance. Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Right? No education, but the guy was brilliant.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, we see it all the time today. We see kids that break out of the ghetto, and they become a CEO of a company or something or other, and then we see others that don't. I mean, there are those people that break away. You look at yourself and you say, have I broken away as I judge other people? No, I'm a middle class man just like my dad was, with a better education than he had, but not for my time.
Yeah, and why you as opposed to somebody else?
But I didn't break away from anything, see?
That's because some of us have to mow the lawns at the mansions, and I'm very good at it.
Yeah, but this is one of those lifelong studies that I've had where I just don't always understand how do two people born in the same circumstance, one become a CEO and one a criminal, or one understands, one accepts the gospel and the other doesn't accept the gospel. Shana?
Well, I think it's ironic because I know a little about him, and he, I don't even think he could read till he was
12.
He was an adolescent, and he ended up being like one of the first kind of scholarly apostles that we had. So it really,
this
it's
is
a
his
quote
story,
from him,
it?
But it could be about him because he lived that experience.
He did.
You know,
he did, and you just wonder, you know, here's an urchin on the street, and how does this urchin on the street end up, you know, going to Congress? So. All right, so he writes this in general, but I think he easily is writing about himself, because this is probably the best framing I can see of where did this kid come from, given what all the stuff that happened to him. Okay, all right, so let's back up a little bit. So here's his mom, Ann Roberts, and she marries a guy, and just on the year 1857 that B.H. is being born, she hears the gospel taught in Lancashire, England, and it just fires her up, and it stirs her up. And they're street preachers, and she just goes out. Nobody that you'd recognize. She's hearing the gospel from, and she's just inspired by it, and she loves it. Her husband isn't interested. But she keeps going back, and then she wants to be baptized, and he says no. So what ends up happening is that she actually sneaks out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and she's baptized at 3 a.m. While he's asleep, and then she will hurry back home, and she spends the rest of the night trying to dry her hair and dry her clothes, and there by the fire, and I've been in England on a rainy night when you're all wet, and you just stand in front of a little fire or a heater or something like that, and the mist is rising off of your clothes while you're trying to dry your clothes. So she spends all that. He wakes up in the morning, he feels her hair, her hair is damp, and he says, famously, "Anne, I believe thee's been dipped." "Anne, I believe thee's been dipped." "Yes, I did." And so what will happen is, he will then join the church, and then he bounces around all over the place. And then at one point, he's going to start to be an alcoholic, and he will actually abandon the family when Henry is 5 and his older sister Polly is 2, and they have 2 smaller kids, younger than them. So he abandoned, and she doesn't know where he is, but she just knows he's kind of left the church. And he's off near London, and he does some work, and he sends her money for about a month to kind of maintain the house as best he can. He is abusive now, he's alcoholic, and then she makes this incredible decision. "I've got 4 kids, I can't trust him, I don't know what's going on, I now have enough money in my hand to get me to America." Because at that point, going off to Zion and off to America, and remember, they've now established the church in the Great Basin, and everybody wants to go to Zion, to America to begin with, but to Zion especially. But she has enough money in her hand for 3 of them, but not 5. So she makes an incredible decision at that moment. "I'm going to take the 2 youngers and myself. I will farm out Polly and Henry, the son, BH, with members in the ward, and I'm going to go off to Zion and then send for them." So that's what she does. Now, BH is going to record this, and so here in his writings is what he says. "As she stepped from the dining table to the pantry door, weeping, I with my childish sympathy plucked her gown, and in my broad Lancashire dialect said, 'Mother, what's up? Why are you crying?' Mother knelt on the floor beside me with her arms around my shoulders, told me of the intended journey to America, to Zion, and how I would be left behind with a brother and sister Toby and sister Mary, Polly, with some distant relatives by the name of Pye. It was only and now a day or two when the separation would take place." He's 5 years old, almost 6. Okay? And his mom's gonna leave him with the Tobys that were from Scotland, and they had moved into the branch. And Polly's going to go with the Pies, okay? "As she held on to me in the story, sobs and tears became more profuse. At last, folding me in my arms, she sought of me brokenly a promise that when I grew to be a man, I would come to her in Zion. Freeing myself from the embrace, I stood erect in the middle of the floor and with childish solemnity promised her, 'I will come.'" 5-year-old. So you just get this sense and her tragedy about what else do I do, and I have this temporary money that I've got that I can actually make this happen. And so that's what happens, yeah.
Do you know whether she was aware of the perpetual immigration fund, and was that available to her when she got
it? I don't know if she knew then, but certainly that's going to be the vehicle that gets them there. The Perpetual Immigration Fund. I don't know if they quite knew that yet, but she was going to go to Zion, make some money, and then send them back. And they won't find out about it for about another 5 years. 4 years. It's 4 years. Okay. So here's what ends up happening with this. Polly goes off to be with one family, and they're actually a good family. The Tobys, on the other hand, that's not their actual name. Anybody ever watch Les Miserables? Okay. These are the Thénardiers. This is the raucous couple that will do anything for a dollar without a regular job, and they just bounce all over the place. They're in England. They've joined the church under an alias. They are really bad people. Now, they will stay active. They'll keep coming to church, so there's some benefit in their coming to the church. But there was no way that Anne Roberts knew what kind of people she was landing her five-year-old son with. And they are a mess. And so what happens is they are bouncing around the towns, taking little odd jobs. At one point, a couple of years in, they find out that Henry can sing. He's got a nice little voice, and he's a cute little guy, but he sings well. Okay, so in church on Sunday, he'll sing, "Let Us All Press On" and stuff like that. And then during the week, they have him in bars singing lusty sailor songs, for which they will get paid. It says, I watched them get paid in coppers, small little halfpennies that they were going to get, okay? But he says, I never saw any of them. They were using that, and so they were just kind of using him. So we had this event, and then what's going to happen here is that he's going to run away a couple of times from this. And he will literally be Oliver Twist on the street. You know, please, sir, can I have another? You know, he's just like doing whatever he can. And at one point he talks about fighting the dogs for the garbage. That he would just, okay, because he's on the street. He's running the streets about when he's about eight. Okay. Now, he has this moment, and this is him talking in retrospect, thinking about it later. On this particular night, following registering to be a cobbler's apprentice, that was a normal thing they would do with kids. You're going to learn a trade, and you're going to learn this trade at 8 and 9 and 10 and go work for a cobbler or a blacksmith or a seamster or something. There wasn't childhood for the kids in England. They were working early on in life, and this is how they usually did it as an apprenticeship. On this night, following the registering for a cobbler apprenticeship, after sleeping some time, I awoke. He has these things that happen. I awoke and was strangely awake, eyes staring out of the darkness, which only relieved by the dim lights of the street coming through the windows and pattering the windows on the opposite walls. Restless, I tossed from side to side, and presently a calmness, then a voice was heard saying, if you are apprenticed to the shoemaker's trade tomorrow, you will never see your mother in America. Again, he's about eight here. Okay, you'll never see your mother in America. Then stillness and the recurring question in my disturbed mind, what should be done? How much time elapsed during these questions, I did not know, but presently I found the resolution formed in my mind that I would run away, which he does. So now he's out on the streets. He's gone for months. Eventually, they're trying to find him. A police officer finds him and brings him back to the Tovies. He will be there for another while. He will then escape again. He will then go back out again. He's on the street for a while. They capture him one more time. And at this point, the Tovies are doing what a lot of people up in Lancashire are doing. That is that now they're starting to hear that saints are getting on boats and they are sailing for America. And there might be a way to fund that. So they then go down to, they take Henry down to Liverpool, down to the docks, connect with one of the wards and the gatherings of saints in Liverpool. Okay? So now it's 1865. Brigham Young is said to be looking for the Roberts boy. So there's the word going out among the saints in England that they've got Polly, but they don't have Henry. Where's Henry? So they're looking for the Roberts boy. So when they get to Liverpool, they're able to find the Roberts boy and reunite him with Polly. And then they're aware of the perpetual immigration fund. There is a way for us to make it to Zion And the Perpetual Immigration Fund is going to fund us on our getting on the boat and making it out to Zion, okay? Which is kind of a remarkable thing. The Perpetual Immigration Fund was one of the things that was seized during the polygamy stuff in the 1880s. And all of these saints were not able to make it. Now, remember too, and we've talked about the fact that at this moment in Salt Lake City, there were about 10,000 saints, maybe 12, okay? In England, there were 30,000 saints. And it was said that by the 1870s, if you were walking down the street in Salt Lake City, you would hear more English accents than you would American accents. And then ultimately Danish and stuff like that. But England was one of the authors said that it was the flower of England that was sailing for America. They were the best, were on their way, okay? So Brigham, they find the Roberts boy, and they reunite him with Polly, and then off he goes, okay? Now, I'm not gonna, there's a lot in his writings about the trip from Liverpool to New York. Little things like he loved being out on the deck, and the storms would come, and he would just kind of almost lash himself down to the deck because he liked being on there. Because down below was a bad news, moldy bread, stale water. One deckhand was particularly hard to get along with, and didn't like these Mormons running around. And at one point he gets a sandwich from another sailor, and it's like the best thing he's ever had. You know, he hasn't had this kind of food for forever. But that trip takes about 6 weeks at sea, and they're all over the place. Okay. Now, think about this. Then once they get there, there's this long trip, 13 days, Long Island. They're gonna take the river up to Montreal. They will cross over Niagara Falls, where he watches a lady almost try and commit suicide. She's tired of being on this train, and she tries to jump, and they have to grab her. So he's watching that kind of thing. Then they get to Chicago, come down the river, down to Quincy, Illinois. And then that gets them then a short trip out to Council Bluffs, where they're going to be outfitted with a wagon, and now we're going to be on our way to Utah, out to Salt Lake. Okay. The interesting. This is 1865. Anybody know your Utah history? When did the transcontinental train? When was the connection at Promontory Point?
Was it
69? Anybody know?
69.
This is another four years, and they've been able to ride the train all the way to Salt Lake. So there was always a sense for those who had made this difficult trip from the sailing to the smaller boats to the wagons to, you know, to getting out to Salt Lake. They've done all of these things. These were the Pryors, and then everybody else that took the train from New York all the way to Salt Lake, they were kind of cheating. Well, it just wasn't really fair what was happening there. But he will then be 6 weeks out there, and so in July of 1866, the wagon train begins. Now, for Brigham and for Polly, Brigham has been wearing the same clothes for 4 years. Okay. Polly has been wearing the same dress for 4 years.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So was he Brigham Henry?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Sometimes I'll use Brigham and sometimes I'll use Henry. Yeah. B-H.
Oh, okay.
Okay. In fact, he's just a Henry Roberts, and then once he gets to Salt Lake, she tacks on Brigham. So she actually gets the elders when he's baptized to call him Brigham Henry Roberts. Okay? So sometimes they'll call him Brigham, sometimes Henry. Okay? Okay, so he's going to start. So they're wearing the same clothes that they've had for 4 years. and inadequate shoes. So really, they walked, what they really did is walk from Council Bluffs to Salt Lake, most of the time barefoot, right, in July. Okay, so they're blistered and they're fevered and they're sunburned and all the stuff that would go with that. Okay. Now, I do think it's interesting, by the way, there is one other moment here that will play into this. When they come past Fort Bridger in Wyoming, there was a Pony Express stop along there that the Indians had found and burned and killed the occupants of the Pony Express stop, okay? And as the wagon is going by there, there's a body lying out, halfway in, halfway out of this stop, right? And his body's burned. But as Brigham, as Henry is walking by here, he also notices that there are a pair of shoes on this body. So when nobody's looking, he sneaks back and to pry the shoes off of this body. And then he will take the shoes back and he'll hide them in the wagon and finish the rest of the trip into the Salt Lake Valley barefoot. Okay. Now, the other thing that they were looking for, and I thought this is one of the great stories of the pioneer groups, and I don't know if we always appreciate this really well. If you're doing a handcart, this was not a handcart group, they had wagons. But if you're a handcart group, can you carry enough food in your handcart to go all the way from Council Bluffs to Salt Lake?
No.
How did they do it?
I thought they had some wagons with them.
They had some wagon with them, but?
Oh, they also sent people out to give them more food.
They did. So what was happening here is they would say, okay, you're going to start from here. You need to carry enough food to get you halfway there. Then you have to trust that there are supply wagons coming from Salt Lake that will meet you somewhere across, usually Wyoming, and restock you. That's part of what happened with Willie and Martin and Car Company, is that they didn't know they were coming, so they hadn't sent the supply wagons. And it's only when they found out that everybody is riding like crazy to go out and rescue these wagons with more supplies. Well, as it turns out, my pioneer grandfather, as we talked about, was one of those with the Martin Handcart Company, and he's in the Seven Miracles, or no, not Miracles, what's the one with?
Seven.
Yeah, maybe Seven Miracles. Anyway, ours is there, and he is, and they're giving blessings, stuff like that, but they were bringing the supply wagons out. And the same thing is going to happen with this one. Somewhere across Wyoming, they're met by the supply trains coming from Utah. And again, it's Arza, is my guy. And Henry is going to be really attached to Arza Hinckley because he sees this compassionate guy, a caring guy. He's leading the supply wagon, but he saved us. He brought us supplies. Okay. But I also think, have you thought about what kind of faith it takes to take off across a continent with not enough food, not enough supplies, and trust that somebody's going to be there for you when you get there, somewhere along the way. I've always thought, isn't that interesting that in a certain sense, isn't that kind of what the gospel thing is? We're going to get met halfway.
Coming from England or Denmark or Europe, they had no comprehension of the distances.
True.
And the geography and climates that are going to be.
Oh, boy, is that...
You could write it down, but...
there were times in
We've
England...
We've got kids that can't make trek.
Yes, and it might be hot.
Yeah.
You know, I think people stop me, you know, at a door or something like, oh, you're from America. Yeah. I've got an aunt in Philadelphia. Do you know her? It's just a concept of this. But again, from a gospel standpoint, I'm thinking about how far are we carried on our own strength, and at what point do we get strength from somewhere else to continue on what we need to do?
Did the Tovis come along?
No, no, they stayed behind.
Did they, was it ever known of the treatment that they were given to the boys?
Yeah, only but only after BH was telling his stories about how bad they were. Because they were using aliases, so they didn't even know exactly who they were.
So they didn't come along?
Not that I know of.
Do you know if the Pies did?
I don't. I kind of suspect they might have. But there's no question that when, when BH is reunited with Polly, they're also told, A, Brigham Young's looking for you, and B, when you get to New York, Mom has sent you additional clothes for both of you and a small amount of money that will help in that journey. Well, the guy that was supposed to give them the money in New York swindled them out of it, and they never got that. Okay, so there was a sense that they were kind of on their own on the boat, and then they were really kind of on their own in the wagon trains out there. It was so Polly was really she's now kind of the ripe old age of about 16, I think, as we're doing this, 15, 16, and she's taking care of her younger brother.
Do we know how it is that Brigham Young was looking for the robber's boy? Did he have a relationship at all with the mother?
No, but she made sure he knew. I mean, this was actually Ann working behind the scenes, and she was petitioning them, saying, I left two kids over there. They're on their own. We need to find them. And Brigham Young was sympathetic to that, so they were sending word along the lines that there were these kids that were out there. And they, like I say, when the word gets to Liverpool, yeah, we found that the Pies are saying, yes, we have Mary, Polly, but we have no idea where Henry is. So that's why they're kind of using that community to try and find them. So, but she's beating the drum over there. She's just really beside herself.
But she must have been a very forceful lady to be able to.
Oh, she was. Yeah, she was. Even to say, I've got to make tough decisions. And so, yeah, she was.
She kind of reminds me of the importuning widow.
Oh, a bit. Yeah, that'd be a good way to say it.
Yeah.
Because she really was.
Did she ever get married again or anything?
Four
times.
Well, she married three additional times. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. So the supply train's coming now. For the first time, really, in all of Henry's life, they have more abundant food and things, but they still don't have any new clothes. But now they're eating better than they ever were, and now they're out on the.
And their clothes don't fit.
Yeah, well, he's doing things like he's a kid. So now we have this, you know, he's 10 and 11, he's out there, and so he relates a couple of stories. One I thought was interesting. There was one of the supply wagons had a lot of had big bags of sugar in it, and it went through the. They had to get through a river, and they got to the other side. And what was happening is that the water was dripping off of these sugar bags.
Oh,
and he and a little girl were like crawling underneath the wagon, trying to get the streams of sugar water coming off of the bags of sugar. Right? There's another time where there's a barrel of molasses. And the barrel of molasses is about half full. And he's trying in the middle of the night to sneak in and get molasses and give himself a little midnight treat, right?
This is not good.
And he hears noises coming out there, and he's afraid he's going to get caught getting into the molasses. So what does he do? He gets in the barrel. That's right. So Henry will hide in the barrel of molasses all night long. And the next morning, then when it's time to go, he's got to own up to this. So they open the barrel of molasses, and there's this little boy in there. And he's got to climb out of this barrel of molasses. Now he's covered with molasses in the bottom part. And they've got to go. We don't have time to wash you off. So he's got to march all day covered in molasses and then coated in dirt. Coming from the molasses, and that's Henry, and you start to get this personality that is just taking off. Okay, well, here comes the next part to this, okay? Okay, so now there is, I need to know, there's a tradition then among the saints as they're coming to Zion that says no matter how hard it's been on the trail, when we're going to walk into Salt Lake City, we want to be our Sunday best. So they would put on their Sunday best clothes. They would stop up Immigration Canyon at a stream, completely wash and bathe themselves and comb their hair and put on their best clothes, and we're going to get ourselves ready to walk into Zion with heads held high. Sunburned, blistered, but heads held high, right? What's Brigham got? What's Henry got?
Molasses.
Pair of shoes.
And a pair of shoes. So he's going to put on what he's got. Polly will actually stay up all night trying to wash his clothes. And he will put on the oversized boots, and he's going to lead the procession in. There was little sleep for Harry that night, the night before. He and his sister were too excited. Harry was up in haste at the first streaks of light. Breakfast neglected, they straggled down the well-defined road entering the city on Immigration Street. In a scrapbook entry, Roberts placed a Tribune clipping dated September 15, 1910, on which he scribbled that the company turned north on Broadway on 3rd South and Main at about 10 a.m. If so, the last leg of the journey, less than 15 miles, took about 5 hours because they're tired and they're worn, and give you some idea of the speed. But they're coming downhill, but it's just hard, right?
3 miles an hour is not.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's a good cliff, actually.
Polly, who had lost her hat early in the journey, had hair as bleached as Harry's by sun and wind. She was ashamed of her tatty clothes, her sun-coarsened hair and face. So when people, all veterans of the same crossing, all warm and welcoming, so picture the parade. People coming out of their houses, they've done this. So they're very appreciative. Here comes the next group of our saints. Okay, and they're all aware of what they've been through, so they're all veterans. Begin coming out of their houses to greet the new company. Polly hides in the wagon. She's just embarrassed of how she looks. Okay, again, she's about 16, so she's, you get that feeling, right? Harry was not the least intimidated by the spectators and pushed himself to the head of the company, waving at horsemen who dashed up swinging their hats and kerchiefs. Hurrah for Zion, right? Ignoring Polly's whispers, get back, he strode ahead like the drum major in a parade. Now, at one point as he's coming down the street, there's a girl that comes out, and she's got fresh fruit, and she's got peaches, and she's got grapes. And she's offering it to him as he comes. Well, when was the last time he saw a peach? When was the last time he tasted fresh grapes? Well, he's so excited by this whole thing, he eats the grapes, but then he takes the peaches and he runs back to the wagon and slips them to Polly, hold on to the peaches, so that he can then hustle back out to be the drum major on this parade as it's coming into Salt Lake in oversized boots. Can you just picture this thing? Why they haven't made a movie out of this, I have no idea, because it's about to get better. It's about to get better. If you just picture this moment, right?
Well, 4 years of a growth of a young boy and four-year-old pants, they've got to be little pants.
Yeah, he did. Exactly. Exactly. Okay? So here's the deal. So what they do is they would come down Immigration, and then they'd pull into near the Lion House where Brigham Young had stables. And then they would then, that's where kind of the parade route would end. Polly and I seem to be so little of this excitement and joy, nobody seemed to come for us. Polly remained concealed under the wagon cover, and I, lonesome and heartsick, sat upon the tongue of Captain Chipman's wagon, my chin in my hands, elbows on my knees, thinking, Zion's not much after all. I was expecting streets paved with gold. There's not much to it. This spirit of sadness, if not forlornness, settled upon me. Presently, however, approaching the west gate, I saw a woman in a red and white plaid shawl, slowly moving among the hillocks of fertilizer. Just picture that, okay? That had been raked from the sheds and the yard. She seemed to be daintily picking her way. There was something in the movement of her head as she looked to the right and to the left that seemed to me familiar. The woman was moving in my direction, and the closer she came, the stronger the conviction grew upon me that this was my mother. I would have known her from her dainty cleanliness of everything about her. I stood until she came nearly parallel to where I sat. Then, sliding for the tongue of the wagon, I took a few steps, which brought me near to her. And plucking her gown, I said, "Hey, mother." She looked upon my upturned face. Without moving, she gazed upon me for some time, and then said, "Is it you, Harry?"
Is it Harry or Henry?
Henry. Did I say Harry?
Bunch of times.
Yeah, I copied this. So maybe he's also using Harry.
Harry is calling him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Harry and Henry. "Is this you, Harry? Where's Polly?" Okay. Of course, Polly was hiding, and I led my mother to where she was hiding. And when mother and daughter met, there was a flood of tears on both sides. I at last joined them in making the trio of united family. It seemed difficult for mother to realize that these at last were her children after more than 4 years of separation. But once in a while, a smile would break through the tears, and she seemed to be supremely happy. Okay. Like I say, that's a moment that I'd like to see well captured on film.
So is the indication that she didn't get so emotional when she met him, but just her daughter?
Yeah, I think she was just kind of shocked and looking at this whole thing, and then she just kind of breaks down when she knows that they're all three of them together, right? Okay? So that is the moment, and then they will then get a wagon. They will then head off to Bountiful. She was living in Bountiful. And when he rides into Bountiful, he's going to look up and he's going to see the Bountiful Tabernacle being built. And he's just like, "Mother has hit the mother load here. You know, this is an awesome place." And then she says, "No, that's not my house. It's this little dugout behind the house, behind that thing." And that's where she's going to be. Okay? Skip over a few things here, but his early years then end up being very, very interesting. Because now he's lived on the streets, he's learned how to be a survivor, he's had to grow up quickly. So his teen years are actually spent at the copper and silver mines, and they get him drinking. So after everything that he's been through, and he talks about the first couple of times they gave him alcohol and it was nasty and it spit him out, but he also got drunk the first time that he drank, and then he just kind of couldn't start leaving it alone. And so he's hanging out when he's like 13, 14, 15, 16. He's hanging out with miners in the silver mines down at Kennecott, the copper mine. And he's just carousing, and he's just kind of he's off the beaten path here. Mom has remarried, but the first husband turns out also to be another alcoholic. She's still having a hard time picking him, and he will leave her. It's their third husband that will be a really good guy. But he goes through this carousing in his early years. Now, early on here, he also is going to enough school that he's finally learning how to read. And he's getting a little better at reading as he's going here. And actually, he's starting to read a lot. And he starts to read. So while a lot of the miners were doing other things, he would be in his little bunkhouse reading a lot. He just turned into a voracious reader. Okay. Then, when he's about 17 or 18, there's a blacksmith in Centerville that takes Henry under his wing, and he's going to apprentice him as a blacksmith. But he makes sure that he's going to school, he makes sure that he's reading, and as it turns out, in this school, Henry starts to excel, and then an interesting thing happens. Around 18, there's a speech contest. And in the speech contest, one of the general authorities, and I can't remember who it was, listens to the speech contest, and Henry nails it. He just is like the best speaker in the group. And this GA, this general authority will then start taking Henry with him on speaking engagements as far as Logan and up and down the Wasatch Front. Because it turns out Henry has a gift of speaking. And he's starting to read, and he's articulate. Well, at that point, he kind of graduates at the top of his class, and then he gets one of the very coveted scholarships to go study at Deseret College, the early forerunner for the University of Utah. And he's then able to go to Deseret, and he just plunges at Deseret College into the classics. And he lists a list of all the books he read, including, you know, Homer and the Iliad and Blackstone's court proceedings, and he's reading everything, especially the classics, The Rise and Fall, Roman Empire, he's just doing a deep dive into this, and he's starting to write. So he becomes a voracious reader of the classics. So his teenage years are kind of disappearing really quickly behind, and he's really kind of discovering really who he is. And then, just as he's finishing at the top of his class at Deseret College, he then marries a woman and almost immediately is called on a mission to the Southern States, which he will then go and serve well around Tennessee, Kentucky. And he ends up being a great speaker, and he's starting to write tracts for the mission. He's starting his writing career. Okay. Now at age 24, he comes back. He's home for about 6 months. They call him back out on another mission, where he's going to serve as the assistant mission president over 24 elders serving in Tennessee. He needs a good secretary, one that would match his personality. Who would be a good mission secretary for B.H. Roberts? J. Golden Kimball. So J. Golden Kimball is his mission secretary, a little younger than him, but their personalities work well against each other, and they will do a lot of preaching together, J. Golden and B.H. Roberts.
So I assume he was separated from his wife during that time?
She's staying at home.
Did they have children?
Yeah, they had a couple of kids. Okay. And they would do this a lot. I mean, they would get called. And I was telling somebody last night, we were doing like a podcast for the ward here. But I was just telling again the story of where my dad marries my mom right at the end of World War II. And right, kind of the last year of World War II, by 1945. Anyway, he comes home to finally get to be with my mom because they got married while he was on leave. And he and my mom settled down together. But almost immediately, as the war is ending, the church wants to send missionaries out. And so the local 70s group in that ward in Salt Lake asked my dad if he'd serve a mission. So he had to look at my mom and say, would you be willing to support me on a mission? And she says, yes. So my dad... they've only been married now just a few months. My dad goes on a mission to Tennessee and to West Virginia. And my mom goes back to live with her parents until he gets back from his mission. So I kind of identify with this.
Was it a two-year mission?
Almost three.
Yeah, basically.
Almost three. And he got really sick at one point. My mom goes out to try and get him. He's not leaving the mission. First presidency has to get involved because they want to send him home, and he won't go home.
And he says,
I'll go home in a box. The only way I'm going up, I'm leaving my mission, is like feet first. Okay, well then, Elder Hand, and the president of the church makes that decision. So Jay Golden is set, and then we have this moment. It's 1885, I think. The southern pushback of Mormons is getting worse and worse, and it's all centered around polygamy. And rumors are out there that missionaries are grabbing young girls and taking them off to Utah for polygamy. And so there's a night that a mob attacks and kills two elders and two members at Cane Creek. Four people killed and one member of the mob is killed. VH will have his own experience with lying in a cabin while they're shooting bullets into a cabin, and bullets are whistling over the top of them. So he understands, but this tragic thing happens. Well, he's up in Nashville. This is down in Cane Creek, farther down. And it's interesting, he records this experience. He just had finished an article for the Improvement Era, made ready for mailing. I prepared for retirement and extinguished the lamp. To my astonishment, there was no diminution of light in the room. Every object was as vividly seen as before the lamp was extinguished. Turns off the light, it's still light in there, okay? This, of course, was something of a mystery to me. And instead of immediately retiring, I walked about the room trying to account for the strange phenomenon. I thought perhaps it was an unusual afterglow of the lamplight, and with the thought of correcting my sight, I threw myself upon the bed face down in the pillow, hoping in this way to exclude the light till my eyes became properly adjusted. I'm trying to get some sleep, and I can't get it to get dark in here. Okay? After a time, on raising my head, I still found the light undiminished. I lay marveling at it for hours, nearly through the night, in fact. But with the breaking of day, I fell into a restless sleep. When I awoke, the sunshine was brightly slanting into the room from the east. Interesting thing. And then first thing in the morning, Elder Kimball delivers the news about the deaths of the missionaries. Right? Now, a couple of things are going to happen right after this, because technically he's the mission prison. The governor is campaigning in Nashville that day. And he will go to the governor. He will go directly to the governor, because what he's also hearing from Salt Lake is we need to bring those bodies home. Those missionaries need to be returned to Utah where they can be buried. And there's no, that's going to be a pretty dangerous thing given all the feelings that are present down in that area. He goes to the governor, and the governor gives him approval to go exhume the bodies that they've just thrown in a shallow grave. Governor's given him approval to do it, and even going to give him some letters so that the local authorities will let him come and exhume the bodies down there so that they can take them home, okay? But even then, most people are saying, that's nuts. Don't go do that. That's a dangerous thing. You're going to get killed doing that. So how is a mission president supposed to go down to this area to exhume the bodies when they all know you from your past mission? And he'd been down there, and so he's a well-known figure in this area. What are you going to do? You'll go in disguise. You're going to go in disguise. So 1844, he says that he dresses up like a hobo. He shaves off his beard.
Is that actually him?
Huh?
Is that him?
That's him. That's actually B.H. Crawford. He got a good picture of him before he went. Then he's gonna have to go down there. So he will roll into town, he will grab a couple, and he will talk to the local authorities that I'm here to exhume the bodies, and he will grab one of the members of the branch there to help him. And this strange guy is there coming to get the bodies and get the missionaries, okay? They will get down there, and there's a crowd. They've heard that this is happening. There's a crowd standing around these shallow graves, and they will kind of boldly come in and exhume the bodies, and they will put them in the wagon. Now, it's been a couple of weeks. And one of the things that one of the members will do is light a big bag of tobacco so that it's putting smell out there, because the smell is horrendous. And B.H. says that he had to put his face in a barrel of water a couple of times to prevent himself from gagging. How bad it was. And so they will, you know, put him in the back of the wagon. Ultimately, they'll put him in the caskets. They get farther out of town, then they'll spend the night at one of the members' houses, and they'll turn to this hobo guy. They're like, "Who are you?" And he goes, "You don't recognize me?" And he kind of pulls it back, and they go, "President Roberts?" "Yes, it's me." They hadn't even recognized him while he was down there. Okay. All right. Amazing, huh?
Yeah.
Tennessee actually put up a historical sign.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, it's still there. You go down that area, you can actually see this. Okay, there is one other experience here. On another occasion, Roberts was addressing assembly, and I think Jay Golden is there with him. When there was a clatter at the door and a man armed to the teeth stepped in and announced his intent to break up the meeting. Roberts was quoting a passage on love from the New Testament. He stepped down from the lectern, walked down the aisle, his eyes fixed intently on the eyes of the disturber. He walked slowly, quoting as he came until he was almost nose to nose with the man, who sank meekly into a chair. Roberts returned to the pulpit and continued the meeting. What are the chances that his experience in the mining camps and even on the streets of England as a boy had prepared him for these kind of things? He just was not going to be intimidated by rougher individuals, okay, because he understood it. He had been one at one point. He's a perfect personality for this. Okay, questions so far? Amazing stuff, right? Yeah.
I would have to imagine that they shoveled lime or something over the bodies to enable them to get them from Tennessee all the way to Utah.
Well, yeah, but when they got them into a steel casket and they got them sealed off and got them onto a train, then they could do that. But
wasn't
right.
That before the train, though? You said the train.
No, this is 1884. So by then, the train, they could just get them onto a train and go right to Salt Lake.
How long did that take?
Probably a week or so, I would imagine. Yeah.
B.H. Roberts, I was just thinking of Brian's comment earlier about the account of them coming into the valley and how it appeared that the mother paid more attention to Paul. Anyway,
yeah.
He was a historian, and you know, history is written by the victors.
No question.
And it kind of gives a little view into how, as he starts writing church history, he likes to ignore some of the more controversial stuff.
And either in himself or others or something like that. So you're always looking at, look through his eyes, right? Okay, so that's that. Okay, so now, so what's next after he gets back? Well, again, this is just a guy that just kind of keeps on growing and expanding in what he's doing, because already it's amazing the things that he's done. Next, he'll go back, 1886, he's now going to start working as an editor for the Salt Lake Herald. And he's also writing articles for the Improvement Era, and he's been writing tracts when he was a mission president, and his stuff is getting published all over. He's becoming very, very well known, and he's now about to be called, he's going to be called as a 70, to the Corps of the 70. But because he is so widely known, also, he's going to come home as a good elder. This is right in the middle of kind of the, we're trying to buttress everybody. He's going to do what a good elder in the church would do. He takes a second wife. He's going to marry her. I can't remember her name, but he marries a second wife. But because he's so well known, he's now arrested for UC, unlawful cohabitation, after taking a second wife. By the way, she will then be spirited off to, she goes off to Colorado for about 5 years. And what are we going to do with B.H. Roberts? Well, he's a man of talents. We don't want him sitting in prison. even though Lorenzo Snow had been there and a number of other, what are we going to do with it? Well, what they do is they the church, and the First Presidency actually posts a $1,000 bond for him to get out of jail, and then he's immediately sent off to England to edit the Millennial Star. So we know he's going to break bond, and off he goes. And in fact, he'll say on the train from Salt Lake to Denver, he's riding the train, and he's riding under an alias. And somebody's walking up and down the aisle. So we have a telegram, let's say it's Mr. Edwards. I don't remember what it was. Telegram from Mr. Edwards. You know, Mr. Edwards. And he became aware that this was part of the sheriffs that were trying to hunt him down because he broke bond. And so he just refused to answer. And then he gets to Denver, and he hides from him a little bit under this alias, and then gets another train off to New York. Okay, so they're really looking for it. So he will then go, he's going to edit the Millennial Star, he's going to serve for 2 years, then he's released to come home. By the way, while he's in England, he's editing the Millennial Star, and his articles are going out all over the place. He has a celebrated series of lectures against a prominent anti-Mormon speaker, and they will go from the north of England all the way down to Wales and do these big lectures. And almost every lecture, this guy will be louder and more obnoxious and the crowd more sympathetic, and they have to kind of whisk BH out the back door. But he keeps doing it over and over and over because he's trying to get the truth out. And sometimes because his arguments are so compelling, you know, the guy's got, they're getting frustrated. But anyway, so he has quite a name for himself in England for about, during those 2 years. And he's kind of known as the defender of the faith. So he's actually going to come home, 1880. That's when he's called to the Quorum of the 70. So now he's even more famous. But what happened to that warrant? What happened to that? Are they just going to let that go? No, he's going to get rearrested. And he's going to be convicted of skipping bond, and he's still convicted of UC, even though his wife's now in Colorado. So he's given the usual 6-3 sentence. 6 months in jail, $300 fine. So he will go off to the territorial prison, and he'll be there for about 4 months before he's released. And then it's right, this is 1889. And then what's going to happen in 1890? The manifesto. So now with the manifesto, they can let him out of prison. UC is no longer, it's being worked its way out. Okay? All right. Couple of last things then. It's about 20 till. I have a number of things of his writings, and they're really good. I may carry those over to next week. I think this is giving us a good setting for next week. Because there's some, actually, he does some pretty heavy doctrinal stuff that's even resonating today. Currently, his stuff is out there. So he's going to go, they're actually going to be called, as a member of the Quorum of the 70, he's going to serve 5 years in the Eastern States Mission as a mission president. By the way, this is also after he has been elected to the the U.S. Congress. They won't see him. So he got 5 years there, and during this time he will do some interesting things. He's going to spearhead the purchase of the Joseph Smith Farm, the Sacred Grove, and the Hill Cumorah, and the Whitmer Farm in Fayette. That's him. Okay, now, I want, as a side note to this, I want to do a quick little side thing on George Albert Smith, because George Albert Smith will be part of this. Right about this time, when he wants to purchase it, the church would like to purchase it, we have George Albert Smith, future president of the church. George Albert is son of apostles, George A., he's well known among the general authorities, and he's always known that he would end up in the Quorum of the 12. Everybody's told him that. He's expecting that he's going to be an apostle. Okay. And back then, a lot of times, they would announce mission calls and general authorities from the pulpit. You might not even know ahead of time. So he keeps going to conference. It doesn't happen. And so early this time, I think it's about 18 or 1925, he skips conference, goes for a walk. And at that conference, Heber J. Grant calls him as an apostle. From the pulpit, he's not there. So George Albert's been out on a walk, and he comes back to his house, and Heber J. Grant's sitting on his porch. Where were you? Well, I was had other things, and I went for a walk, and, well, we called you to be an apostle today. Really? And he said, hold on, give me a week. Or give me a couple of weeks, and I'll be ready to serve. As Susan Easton Black tells this story. That he says, so he goes in the house, and he says to his wife, if I'm going to be an apostle, I'm supposed to be poor like an apostle. How much money have we got? So she tells him what's in the savings account. He's surprised that she had as much money as she had in there. And he says, okay, I want you to go down to the bank tomorrow and pull it out. And then I want you to sew it in your dress. Why? Well, I got a plan. Sews in the dress. They then buy a train ticket for New York. Off they go to New York with, and she's got, what she's actually got, and I think the church did contribute a little bit. It wasn't completely unknown to them. She's got $20,000 in her dress.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, think about what $20,000 was in 1925.
What was his profession or
I don't remember what it was, but he hadn't really earned the money. She'd been saving it on the sly. He was shocked to find it. She had the savings account that she'd been putting money aside, right? Because he was doing a number of things, including he had a song and dance that he would do, dressed in funny clothes like a clown, and he would juggle, and he did it for youth groups all over southern Utah. George Albert. His story is coming. But this particular one ties in. Okay, so they're going to go off to New York, and he's going to then there you get a little trip up to Palmyra. He's going to go to the what had been the Joseph Smith farm, and he's going to say, and they're kind of dressed a little bit differently, we want to buy your farm. And the man says, well, it's not big of a farm. In fact, I decided what to do with it, and I was just getting ready to cut down that stand of trees right behind the farm. And George Albert says, we want to buy your farm. And he says, well, I don't want to sell it. Well, give me a price. And that you would sell it. Well, it would have to be in cash. Well, how much?
$20,000.
That's right. Wife? pulls up her rip, pin it. $20,000 in cash. Two things. You can live on this for a while. We don't need you to move out right away. And number two,
Don't
chop down the trees. Yes.
We're going to need those.
You're going to need those eventually because it's only the sacred grove behind the farm.
It's kind of important.
Yeah, and we kind of like that stand of trees back there. Don't touch it. And so they're going to allow him to live there for about 5 years before they will then get a caretaker to come move into that. But he will then purchase the farm. And not long after that the church under Heber J. Grant and with B.H. Roberts pushing, says, we really need to buy these farms and do that. And George Albert Smith says, I actually hold the deeds to that, and I will sell it to you for a dollar. So they give him a dollar, and it moves over to the church. Okay. But that was at B.H. Roberts' behest, that he was pressuring the church to buy these properties. So he helps arrange, inspire, and write the Hill Cumorah pageant. Remember, he's a writer. We should have a pageant. And even though it's produced after his death, he is the driving force behind wanting there to be a pageant, and he's writing a lot of the script for that pageant. Okay? This is still him, right? He also he writes a creative story called Coriant and a Nephite story that's first published in Salt Lake. It will then be adapted into a Broadway play. You start to get to this point where you go, is there anything that B.H. Roberts can't do? I'm not finding it yet.
Stay home and take care of his wife?
Yeah, he's not doing that. He's never home.
He's never home.
But he'll add a third wife, by the way.
They're probably all grateful. You can't serve in Congress, right?
Well, let's talk about that. Maybe this is a good way to, this is probably a good place to stop for now, and then, like I say, we'll get into his doctrinal stuff, which is still pretty important. So politically, what's going to happen in 1885, I think? They're getting ready, they're making an appeal to the United States for Utah to be a state. And so they're having to write up a constitution that they can submit to the United States to say this is what Utah would look like. And it's still about 4 years away.
You realize the flag's backwards.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the picture I got, so I figured it's like a stereotype or whatever. So, but it's big, right? It's a big flag. And they want, you know, Utah Star to go. Yeah. Okay, so here's what's going to happen. So he's a little afraid that if they just submit, that polygamy is still a problem, and if they add too many problems to the Constitution, that maybe the United States will turn down the bid for statehood. So there are two hot buttons. One is polygamy. The other is suffrage. Should women get the vote?
Oh, because they allowed women to vote in Utah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if we, but they're not allowing the women to vote the rest of the United States. So if we're going to allow this state to come in where it's allowing women to vote, that may scuttle our application. Plus, you know what? Politics is kind of a dirty business.
Okay.
And women have a more gentle sense about them, so they probably shouldn't be involved in politics anyway.
Besides, we like the control.
Yeah, maybe. So he, in 1895, so he opposes women's suffrage. And politics are too demeaning, it might derail statehood, with just one more controversy. Okay? It's later than that, 1895. So Utah becomes a state in 1896, and who is it that's going to be elected to the House of Representatives? B.H. Roberts, why not? Okay, but he also has three wives that he has not yet, he's not going to denounce them. He's like Joseph F., he's not going to give them up. So that means he's elected to the U.S. House, but he's not seated. Okay? All right.
I didn't even know that was a thing until, you know, that you could be elected, but they're like,
no, we're not allowing polygamists. We're just not. And it'll come up again with Senator Smoot that we've talked about.
That's interesting.
So, hand. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm gonna break here because there are some real. So his writings are just. In fact, the last history of the church was written by B.H. Roberts before what we have now. So, questions on any of this?
Dang.
I know there's a lot, right? There's a lot of this guy's story, and every time, even this morning, I found something else. I'm adding more. Yeah.
I just thought it was interesting. You were saying, I mean, we were talking about the Tennessee massacre and the elders who passed, and my husband, when my kids were on missions, said, no, you can't read the news and find out about missionaries that die while on mission. But I just think the individual stories, right, we have them, and they're not known throughout the church, but that doesn't make them any less powerful, you know, that we all have those stories, and they were having those stories back then, we have the stories now, that I think somehow, I don't know, that the big things matter more.
Well, I also think,
but
and actually this is going to lead us into next week, there has been, he's going to do some He's going to write critically about the scriptures, about the Book of Mormon, about our history. And so he's a critical historian. And it's like the truth will out. We're going to do the truth. His opposition is going to be Joseph Fielding Smith. Joseph Fielding Smith said, along with, you know, and Boyd K. Packer will echo it, that, yeah, you know what, not all history is helpful. So some things we can downplay, we're not going to necessarily bring it out too much. So I think sometimes these stories kind of got, and who was historian of the church for 50 years?
Joseph Fielding Smith.
So some of the stories weren't going to necessarily be promoted and told because we don't want to discourage missionaries, we don't really want to talk about Joseph Smith's polygamy. There's a number of things we really don't want to talk about because our history is our main missionary focus, and we want this to be able to go out. We don't want negative things in our history to get in the way of our missionary effort. How can you gather into Zion if Zion's got problems? So, anyway.
But B.H. Roberts kind of got the last laugh there because they still have the B.H. Roberts Foundation still today that is committed to that idea of just talking about our church's history and being truthful, but trying to do that in a faithful light. And so it's...
Which he did, but because it was critical, he wasn't always seen. Right. We weren't quite sure you're being faithful or you're just being kind of the devil's advocate on these kind of things. So in fact, one of his greatest works that we're going to talk about, The Truth, the Way, and the Life, you know when it was published? 1994. Okay? So some of these things are just now being printed because they weren't out there. And that's why when you start delving into this, a lot of the stuff I didn't know, and I'm starting to see just kind of the depth of his writing and the depth of his understanding, I'm just blown away by what he understood in the 1920s that we are kind of coming back around to understanding now, but it stayed buried for 100 years. Yeah.
You know, when I was in seminary as 15, 16-year-old, our church history book was B.H. Roberts' Church History. That was the
comprehensive history.
Yeah, but it wasn't the multi-volume one. It was just a seminary volume one. Do you know if that's a condensation?
It is, because the other thing that we're going to talk about is that he actually wrote the Elders Quorum Manual, and so all of the Elders Quorums in the church were using his little manual, because he was a historian, but he's taking a lot of what he has learned and condensing it so they could do it for lessons, unlike for the seminary kind of thing. But yeah, they weren't going to be quoting too much from that book, The Way, the Truth, and the Life, because it's more in depth. It's like, the Book of Mormon's got some holes, let me tell you about it. So they were excited to hear it, so anyway. Final comments on that? I realize it's more of a lecture thing and a little bit different, but stunned, yeah.
Just curious, so on women's suffrage in Utah, when did it start? Did it stop then for them?
Stop here. That's why women's suffrage is going to, the big push is going to be like 1930s?
Well, no, they were granted suffrage in 1930, I thought.
Everybody was, but they lost suffrage.
But
so there's a period of time where they had lost their ability to vote. Until national suffrage by one of the an amendment to the Constitution. But he was kind of fighting it at the time, but women had been voting for a long time in the territory. So anyway, okay, so let me finish by just doing this. Again, in spite of different parentage and vicious environment, but Vicus, bad environments. Some characters arise that are truly virtuous and great, that purely by the strength of that intelligence and nobility to which their spirits had attained in the heavenly kingdom before their bodies took upon earth. Their grandeur of soul could not be suppressed by environment of this life, however inauspicious their development. As the sun struggles through the clouds and mists, and it sometimes obscures brightness, so these spirits, You could actually be saying me. So these spirits, stirred by their innate nobility, breaking through the disadvantages attendant upon ignoble birth and iron fortune, rise to their native heights of true greatness. I think that's B.H. Roberts, to a T. He just rose out of nowhere, and there's so many places he could have gone south, and he didn't. In fact, he just everything he happened to him caused him to be greater and more powerful over time. So I bear my testimony that we kind of bear the legacy of some of these great souls that laid the foundation of the church and were the beneficiaries of it. I leave that with you in Jesus' name.
Amen.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.